And we're going to go right now to a little bit of a chit-chat about Linux and understanding why it's important. And I'm speaking with...
My name is Biela Coleman, and I'm here at the Ruckus Society, and I've been presenting some on free and open source software. I'm an anthropologist out of the University of Chicago working on my dissertation research on the ethics and politics of the free software movement. Let me explain a little bit what the free software movement is and what it's based on. Software application, whether it's an operating system like Microsoft or other types of application like Adobe eReader, is proprietary. What that means is that the source code is not available for viewing or use. And also, when you buy one copy of a proprietary software application, you're the only one who has a right to use it. And often it's a very expensive sort of piece of software. The free software movement has been creating software and protecting it with new legal licenses. One of the most famous ones is the GNU General Public License, also known as the copyleft. And what it does is that it allows you to make copies of the software legally, but more importantly, it gives you access to the source code so that other programmers can view it, maybe modify it. And if they make any modifications, then their modifications are subject to the copyleft. To sort of the normal non-techie user, what's significant about free software is now that there's available a whole sort of plethora of free software and open source tools and applications, which are either free in the sense of free in terms of money or available at a very low cost. And this is a really nice thing for nonprofit organizations and schools and governments who don't have a lot of sort of resources or money to spend on this sort of thing. Also, by using free software, you tap into a whole community and an alternative way, or supporting an alternative way of producing knowledge as well as protecting it.
I wanted to go back there to a moment to the schools. Some of the schools retroactively have been mandated by Microsoft. If they're going to use their software, they're paying $40,000 or $60,000, in some cases even more, in order to bring their licensing things up to code.
I do know about the fact that Microsoft was going to make some big donations to schools, but their only requirement was, if we're going to make donations, you're only allowed to use Microsoft products on your hardware. I remember when they made that announcement, they had to retract because there was such uproar over that, because they were sort of mandating their charity under certain provisions, which was really ridiculous. But one of the problems with using Microsoft applications is if you need to upgrade, you have to pay for the new license, which is very, very expensive because you have to pay per sort of application. And so if a school district has, you know, 30,000 computers, that's 30,000 licenses at $100 a piece, that's $30,000. With free software, once you have it installed and running, you could get new upgrades and software essentially for free. Admittedly, it's a little bit harder to sort of install and get running some of the free software applications, but there's resources you can use in your community to help you with that sort of process. And I'd like to mention two groups that have done a really good job at sort of helping other types of communities install and use free software. One is in Portland with a Portland Linux user group, which has helped the public school system adopt Linux. And then there's a group in New York called, I think it's the New York Linux Scene. And it's a bunch of Linux enthusiasts and advocates who help nonprofits and organizations adopt Linux.
If folks wanted to find out more about how they can get support for Linux operations that they may want to implement in their county buildings, schools, where would they go?
Well, one good thing to do, and I don't have the website on me either, is to do a Google search for Linux user groups, and you will see a page pop up like it's one of the first two links, which is to all the Linux user groups in this country and around the world, and that's a good way to sort of start. I do have my own personal webpage right now. It does have a link with resources on it. That's the URL is www.healthhacker.com. which is with two H's. So healthhacker.com/Biella, B-I-E-L-L-A, /ruckus, ruckus.html. And I've compiled a bunch of basic resources for some of the presentations I did here. Once you have a system up and running, I would say that there's plenty of software available for Linux systems that you won't have a problem in a sense, like you're not going to be missing anything. Also, a lot of people are concerned about, well, will I be able to open my Microsoft Word documents if someone sends me a Word document? And you absolutely can, because there's word processing programs available for Linux through such things as OpenOffice and Abbey Word and StarOffice, in which you can open a file, a Word document. And you could also save as a Word document just in case you need to send a Word document to someone.
Folks out there would like to make the transition to entertain the concept of using Linux. What would you advise them?
I would advise a couple of things, one of which is to definitely contact your local Linux user group. It's a great place to go to get advice. People there are usually more, like, they're completely willing to help organizations and individuals. Most of them hold what's called an install fest, where you can bring a computer and they'll help you install Linux. The other side is just online resources that are available in various websites. Like, going to linux.org is a good place to start to learn about things, and there's many others too.
What's your sense of dual boot operations?
That's actually a really good idea. I was dual boot for a long time. I mean, it was nice because I guess I was still using an email program that I liked a lot with Windows. And it was good because if I brought my laptop somewhere where they had a Windows system, I could just plug in and use everything on the system. I actually got rid of Windows when I got a really bad virus and just entirely got rid of it. And since then, I haven't really missed it. So it's a good option, especially if you're a little bit concerned about the transition. It's a good way to transition.
You mentioned viruses. I think that's one of the fascinating things about Linux is they don't get viruses.
Yeah, they generally don't. I mean, it's in part because people don't write them for Linux because, you know, there's not a lot of political opposition to Linux. And the other thing, too, is in terms of security, because there's many different flavors of Linux or distributions, if you know one distribution, you could sort of maneuver around in another one. But they're different enough that if there's a virus that, let's just say, will affect, I don't know, Slackware, it probably won't affect Mandrake or something, which is a nice sort of security measure to have these different flavors of Linux.
What I wanted to mention or talk about was the sort of spiritual, ethical evaluations of why Linux is an important political thing to do.
Well, one of the amazing things I think about the whole free software and open source movement is a couple of things. One of which is that they're using alternative licenses by which to protect knowledge. And right now we're sort of living in a time period in which intellectual property through patents and copyright and other measures like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act are being applied to information and knowledge in such a way that the layperson is really restricted in her or his use of information, whether it's in terms of the genome or copyright extension. With free software, we have alternative legal means by which to protect knowledge and keep it open. And what they're creating is a sort of repository of information, knowledge, and products. It's sort of like a commons. And I think, you know, as a society that really has such a strong emphasis on privatization, this is a great counter thrust, which says, hey, it's a really good idea to have a commons that anyone can sort of take from. The other thing, too, is just the use of volunteers to create these free software projects like Debian or Apache or GNOME, where hundreds of volunteers spend time to develop this software. They volunteer their time and effort, and I think that's a really good model that would be nice if other professional groups would adopt. I think hackers or programmers have a very strong ethic that they're able to sort of apply and live in sort of a real way through these projects. It's a really powerful model that it would be great if other professional groups, whether it's architects or doctors or engineers, could sort of adopt. And it's not that they would have to stop working in the corporate world, but also create an independent space where they could volunteer their time and effort to create services or goods, whatever it may be. Also, what I think is really great is that the free software movement and open source movement has inspired different projects, one of which I really like is the Creative Commons, which is trying to come up with alternative licenses to protect artistic products. And it's encouraging artists, whether it's media or music artists, to not use copyright to protect their stuff, to use other licenses in which other people can then maybe sample their work, sort of less restrictive licenses to create a commons around cultural products.
I think that's fascinating, the commons intellectual knowledge base.
Mm-hmm. Creative Commons, the website for that is creativecommons.org. They're hoping that artists will use their licenses to protect their artistic works. So it's actually precisely not for software, but it's been, its inspiration was the copyleft that was created by the Free Software Foundation back in the early 1980s.
Speaking of copyrights and issues like that, I know last year Dmitry, I'm not sure of his last name.
Skylarov, or I think I'm mispronouncing it.
Was arrested when he came into this country to attend or to, he was to present some of the work, which revolved around changing a program for blind people, I believe, so that they could actually use computers, and Adobe had him arrested. And maybe you could explain a little bit more in depth about what he was actually doing and then what Adobe was actually upset about.
So he was arrested under a law called the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a slightly complicated act in the sense that what it does is it makes it illegal to circumvent copy protections on software or other sort of media. But it also makes it illegal not just to circumvent it, but to write a program that has the potential to circumvent it or to traffic or distribute that program. So it's meant to protect copyright infringement. But the interesting thing about the DMCA is that you don't need to even infringe copyright to break the law. You just have to create a program that has the potential to circumvent a copy-protected program or work. Now, the interesting thing is that there may be very legal reasons for which you would circumvent a copy-protected program, whether it would be to make a backup of it, a backup of your program, whether it was to make the program, to transform it so that blind people could use it. Maybe you'd want to circumvent it to get access to copy a quote for fair use rights. So there's all these different reasons for which that you might want to get around these copy controls. So Dmitry wrote a program that would circumvent Adobe eBook Reader. When he was presenting about the circumvention, he was arrested. Eventually, Adobe dropped the charges. I believe the federal government, they're the ones that still went ahead with it. But eventually, they dropped it against Dmitry and have just brought it against his employer, which is a Russian software company. I'm not entirely sure what's happening with that. I think that it's set for trial.
Would you say that that Adobe dropped the charges because of bad press?
Yeah, they did. They got a lot of bad press. And it was a really interesting moment, actually, I think, in hacker politics, because a lot of Bay Area hackers and hackers also just around the world and around the nation sort of really banded together, organized, and did some protests at Adobe in San Jose. And it was really powerful, I think. A lot of engineers at Adobe were really unhappy with what Adobe did. And EFF also put some pressure on.
And who is EFF?
EFF is the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization based out of San Francisco that deals with issues of civil liberties related to cyberspace.
Okay, and maybe just we could summarize a little bit about how the future could change in terms of the political horizon future with having Linux. It's sort of like having a third-party politics, like the Democrats and the Republicans, and now we have Linux. I don't know if that's a good analogy.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the amazing thing about it is that it's created a space for society at large to think about how to create products and knowledge in a different system or using sort of a different system, as well as just reviving the idea of a public commons for society in the realm of knowledge, information, and the internet. you know, in this country, we don't think twice about the idea of public parks. And we, I think, would be really upset if all of a sudden all private land was privatized and you had to sort of pay a huge amount. Well, I think that ethic is going, there's a strong ethic to preserve that with knowledge and the internet amongst technical people. And hopefully it gains visibility for society at large and is an ethic that's cultivated outside of technical circles. And Linux, in part, is what makes that possible.
And it would seem to me, as well as the political folks, the activists out there, could do a good part there to contribute by using their changing and transforming their whole computer base into the Linux format in which so we could have a strong front.
Absolutely. I think it really sends a powerful message, and I really do hope that activists who don't have a technical orientation whatsoever, but use computers or technology, which most people do nowadays, really seriously consider it. I think it's a strong ethical support for something that really has the potential to do something good for society at large.
I heard something that was kind of I don't know if distressing is the word, but that Walmart is now selling their computers with Linux as the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
As a you know, because I totally disdain Walmart and think that no one should shop there.
Right. No, that was interesting because on the one hand, it's true Walmart is an sort of organization in terms of
slavery.
Yeah. It's problematic, yet at the same time, it's interesting because in terms of a venue that's going to reach a lot of people, you know, it is one. And that's been the interesting thing if you follow the free and open source movement in terms of its politics. It's had a really heavy hand in the sort of commercial world, which in some ways some people have felt has compromised the ideals of free and open source software. On the other hand, it's also really made a huge impact in spreading it and making it more accessible.
Shades of gray.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Biela and your website once again. So if people want to get further information about Linux or just to stay in touch with what's going on, maybe you could throw out a couple websites and we'll let it go.
Sure. So my website, which has some basic links for Linux and free software up right now, is healthhacker.com/Biela, Biella, /ruckus, ruckus.html.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And we're going to go back to
some
music.